welcome to the second ever episode of Just a Chat. I am Louise Bruton and I am so excited to have this guest on this week. So, without naming any names, I'll explain just a little bit about her first. She is phenomenal on Twitter. She is luminous in real life. She is hilarious in WhatsApp groups. She has been influenced by the sexy trad of Andrea Corr. She loves Bobby Gentry and country music and everything that goes with it. Once upon a time, she thought that Boney M and Britney Spears were contemporaries. She likes to take down the complications of loving Father John Misty, and she doesn't shy away from the brilliance of Max Martin and Taylor Swift. She was once in an indie band, but after Charlie XCX squared up to her at a songwriting camp, she broke up with her fella, left the band, and she started the path that took her to her solo career today. Just in and around the start of lockdown, which is when I spoke to her, she released her debut single, which is called Another Day KFC. And shortly after that, she released the incredible and hilarious music video to go with it. Currently, in real time, right now, she has just released her second solo single, Rodney. The woman I'm talking about is the one and only CMAT, also known as Kira Mary Alice Thompson. She is a gem, and she's only going to keep on shining. I think we're all going to look at now fondly in years to come when she's off winning Grammys. I swear to God, I'm not messing.
So how are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm just going to crack open a cold boy.
Yeah, you were well and truly on route to being sponsored by Diet Coke. Gorgeous.
I feel like if I just keep doing it, they have to at least acknowledge the joke. And then if they acknowledge the joke, they at least owe me something. Do you know what I mean? It'll happen eventually. As my star rises, they'll not be able to ignore me anymore, I hope.
Who was the last big Diet Coke person? Was it Duffy?
Yes. She was the entryway for me in the sense that she was like, when she did that, I want to live, not merely survive. Oh my God, I loved that ad when I was a kid. And she had her little stripy top and her little shorts with her tights. She was so cool. She was like my favorite person when she was around doing bits. I loved her. Oh, she was so cool. Yeah.
Do you still look back on those moments favorably?
With Duffy?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I still think I think she's great. Like, I think, I still think that album stands up, to be honest. Like, if I think, I mean, I haven't listened to it in a very long time, but just thinking back at the songs I know, like, fucking Rain on Your Parade. Oof. Oof. That's spicy. It's just great. I really like her. I like Welsh people, so.
I mean, I think that's a good open attitude to have with the world. Yeah. Just enjoy Welsh people.
I was obsessed with Shirley Bassey when I was like 16, 17. Because I watched a biopic of her. I think Ruth Nega was in it. I'm pretty sure it was Ruth Nega played her. And that's why we watched it. Because it was like on. I was like, oh, she's Irish. We have to watch it. And she did Shirley Bassey. And it was the most dramatic, overblown, like, TV biopic I'd ever seen. But I fucking loved it. And I loved Shirley Bassey. And I became obsessed with her on the... she used to do a lot of appearances on Morecambe and Wise. And she was so funny. And I just was like, oh my God, she's such a good singer. And she's so funny. She has it all. She's everything I want, just to be a good singer and funny. Oh, I love her. And I remember begging my... Leave Insert Music teacher to let me do a Shirley Bassey song for my Leave Insert practical, and she wouldn't let me do it because it was like about having double penetrative sex or something. I think that's it was a song banned by the BBC. It was like her first single, Burn My Candle at Both Ends.
What did you end up doing for your Leave Insert then?
I ended up doing, okay, so there was a couple of songs that my music teacher made me do because she was like, you're going to have to do three of my songs basically. And then you get to pick the other three because you have to kind of show range and stuff. And she's like, I'm just going to pick these three. You're just going to have to do them, get them out of the way. But I actually really liked them. One of them was If I Were a Bell from Guys and Dolls. Do you know that song?
I don't actually.
How do I feel, little me and my quiet upbringing? Oh, so good.
And did you, when you were doing that for your exam, did you do like the full theatrics as well?
Hell yeah. You have to do it. Because so basically you can do the way the higher level music Leaving Cert works is you either do 6 performance pieces or you do 3 performance pieces and music technology. And she was like, it's very hard to get full marks doing 6 performance pieces, but she was like, but you will probably be able to get full marks if you just do what I tell you to do, because she's like, because you're a very good singer, so you'll be able to do it. So I just did the 6 performance pieces because I hate technology. And I did that show tune. I think I did Stormy Weather by Lena Horne as well, because I love that film, Stormy Weather. It's like my favorite film of all time. Have you ever seen it?
I haven't, no. You're just going to give me like a list of things, I think, to like listen to and watch after this.
That's usually what happens.
Yeah, you're in education.
I definitely have my own reference points. I have like my own list of reference points because I didn't leave my bedroom for my whole teenage years. But I did, yeah, Stormy Weather, the film with Lena Horne and Bilbo Jangles Robinson, and he's like 40 years older than her, and he's like the romantic lead for Lena Horne. It's very funny when you kind of watch it now, you're like, he's like her dad. But yeah, she does Stormy Weather, you know, don't know why there's no sun up in the sky. Oh, so good. But my piece de resistance, like my thing that I got to do, and I like planned the whole thing, I like worked on it for a really long time. I did a mashup of Kula Cafe by Serge Gainsbourg and Mama Look a Boo Boo by Harry Belafonte, and I didn't compose it, but I like arranged it myself, and I got a guy to come in on the bass. So it was literally like bass, I had 2 girls doing backing vocals for me, and they were like using maracas and like a peg thing, and then I was singing the lead. So it was basically like I sang the verse of Mama Look a Boo Boo, and then I would sing the chorus from Kula Cafe, and then the last time around I did the verse from Kula Cafe. I have no idea how to pronounce that word, by the way, because I can't speak French.
Well, look, listen, you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
And when you were doing that, like, did you have to do it in your school uniform? Was that like a letdown?
No. I mean, I didn't mind it because I knew I killed it. Because this is 6th year. So by this point, I was wearing like fake eyelashes to school. Like I had fake eyelashes. I had fucking eyebrows up to my gills. I had like fire brigade truck red hair down my arse. Like I'd really, really long, like dyed red hair that used to get me in trouble in school all the time. And I'm not going to talk about, but I hope she rots because she tried to have me kicked out of school for a dye my hair.
Okay. Right. Let's get back to it. Cause you,
sorry.
Yeah. Like personal vendetta is coming to the fore.
Let me just call out this other bitch. No.
We'll do that another time, because you have like your point of references are just like so wide and they're so rich, and I think probably it's fair to say that you're probably always a bit of a unique human being. Am I correct? Can you say this about yourself?
Yeah, definitely. Oh my god, my nanny always uses the same. She always uses the same anecdote, which was I got to be the lead in the nativity when I was in senior infants, so when I was 6 years old.
Who's the lead in the nativity now?
No, so it wasn't the nativity. So when you're in Ninan Bioga, you do the actual proper nativity. And then after that, you're just doing a school musical that's like 10 minutes long each. That was the way we did it in our school. I was in the Gael school. I was in School Oliver. Bolly Blanchair. Shout out everyone there. But what's it called? Yeah, I was in Kerkeen Rua. And so it's like the Little Red Hen, but it was Os Gaeilge. And we like sang songs. I can't tell you what it was. But I was in Kerkeen Rua, and apparently as I was like leaving school, I was like, Kira has left the building. And my nanny said like she just collapsed in laughter, and she's like, oh my god, this child is a demon. And I was a weird kid, definitely. Like there's a lot of weird stories about me. I got kicked out of Tin Whistle class because I told the other kids that I had a third eye. And I had a blunt fringe, and I used to lift up my fringe, and I'd always have like a sticker there, and I'd be like, look into my third eye. And then the Tin Whistle teacher kicked me out because I was too distracting.
Oh, so like the third eye didn't exist in any other class but the Tin Whistle session.
Yeah. No, I have a vague memory of like going to the bathroom beforehand and being like, okay, gotta put my sticker on, freak out these kids, and then like going in and being like, look into my third eye. Just weird stuff like that I hear every so often. But yeah, but I always loved music, so that was my saving grace, that I was like very, very confident. And even though it was very strange and disruptive, I was always like able to put on a show. So it was good.
You'd fall back for your behavior.
Oh yeah, yeah, I'd get away with everything. I used to get away with so much. Like, I was really bold. I used to like take off my clothes in public until I was like 7. Like, I'd always just like strip and then like run away from my mom because it really annoyed her. Obviously, because it's like there's a nude child in public. So I'd like take off my clothes and they'd be like, ha, and, like run away. She'd be like, I gotta Kara, Jesus, Kara, get in. And yeah, that's, yeah.
So you mentioned to me, during the week that you had, was it five CDs in your house when you were growing up?
Yeah. So like the beginning of like my musical education or whatever would have just been like, not in a way that we had like a strict household or anything, and like we weren't allowed to listen to the radio, but we just didn't listen to the radio because we only listened to what my mom listened to. And like the only radio she listened to was Jerry Ryan, and Jerry didn't play that much music. So if it wasn't Jerry Ryan, she'd put in CDs or tapes, and we literally had 5. And if I hear any of the songs now, it's like going back in time, and I can remember every single detail of every single one of those songs. So I think I was talking to my mom about this the other day, just to like get definite on what the CDs were. But one was Boney M's Greatest Hits, and that has never left me. That has had a horrible impact on my life because I've like never been able to move away from my love of Boney M. I've never been.
Nor should you.
No. I when I was 6, 7, 8 years old, like I legitimately thought that Boney M was like a contemporary band. I thought they were like contemporary artists. Like I thought they were going to the MTV VMAs with Britney Spears and stuff, and that they were still performing live. And like you could not have told me that they weren't like a contemporary young person's band, and that they were my favorite band. Like I used to always, you know, like if you're asked to get up at a party or whatever and you're a kid, like, here, do your song. I used to do Brown Girl in the Ring. Brown Girl in the Ring was my song. It's so inappropriate. I was not a brown girl in the ring, but I loved that song, and I just loved them. And I used to lie a lot when I was a kid. I remember being in senior infants. My teacher was like, oh, so does anyone here go to like dance class or speech and drama? And I wasn't, I think at that point I was kicked out of too many of them or whatever. But like, does anyone go to speech and drama? Does anyone want to go to dance class? Like, do you have anything you'd like to show the class? And I was like, yes, I have a dance that I learned in my school. In my dance school. And she'd be like, oh yeah, what is it? And I was, it's Daddy Kill by Boney M. And then I just like got up in front of the classroom and winged it and like did a full performance to all of Daddy Kill by Boney M.
The crowd went wild.
They didn't like it at all. I mean, they probably did. I'm sure the teacher loved it. She was like, what is with this kid? But it was Boney M, The Beautiful South, like very The Beautiful South. My auntie is obsessed with the, she actually, I think, given the opportunity, she would leave my uncle for Paul Heaton in a heartbeat. Like, she's obsessed with him. We went to see The Beautiful South together. Or they're not The Beautiful South anymore, because I think they don't have the rights to use that name.
They've had a lot of changes. So they're kind of like the original Sugar Babes.
Yeah, yeah. So it's just, I think they can't tour with The Beautiful South name, but it's just Paul Heaton and Jackie Abbott. I went to see Paul Heaton and Jackie Abbott in the Olympia, and I looked around, and the amount of women who were like moist at the sight of Paul Heaton was not even, like, he came out in a full jacket. Like, the jacket was down to his knees and up to his chin, and like you could barely see him, and they were just like, yes, Paul, oh my god, yes, I love him. Oh, like, they were absolutely losing their minds.
When was this? Was this like recently?
Yeah, this is like a year and a half ago. Like, this is, and then we went out to McGowan's afterwards, and I got the drunkest I've ever been in my whole entire life, with all these like women in their 40s and 50s who just couldn't stop talking about how much they fancied Paul Heaton, and how, I think it's because he does a lot of songs about unhappy housewives and like unhappy domestic situations, and he writes a lot about domesticity, which is, I think a lot what I write about as well. So like I can see where the appeal is. Like,
well, also I saw Simply Red in concert about 5 years ago, and I have never seen a more out of control crowd than the Simply Red fan base. Like, I had never seen women throw knickers on the stage before. There was at Simply Red in like the Three Arena, it was just women falling at their knees, throwing their knickers on stage. And there was one woman who she would, because it was an all seating show, so whenever people stood up, they were breaking the rules of being at this seated concert. So there's this one woman who wherever Mick Hucknall moved, she would kind of pace along with him. But every time she was moved, the security pulled her back down to go back to her seat. So it was just like this repeat behavior. It was like this mania I'd never seen before. And I've been to One Direction. I've been to Westlife. I've seen like the teen frenzied acts, but something about Simply Red just really tapped into the real feral instincts of women.
Yeah, that sounds a lot like my Beautiful South experience. I love that. I'm really excited for the fact that as I get older, I will probably get more fanatical about the bands that I'm into right now. I think that's nice. I think that's something to look forward to. And I think it just, like, there's a lot less shame, because I think when you're a teenager, you're fully delusional. You're fully delusional. And you're like, if I just behave myself and I be the perfect person, he's going to come down off the stage and he's going to pull me out of the crowd and he's going to bring me up on stage and I'm going to sing one of his songs and then we're going to get married and we're going to have lots of sex and babies and we're going to live together forever in a mansion. Whereas I think when you get to middle age, you're like, it doesn't matter. I got nothing to lose. I'm going to have the best time of my life. I'm going to absolutely throw my knickers on the stage of Paul Heaton. It's going to be a great time. And that's, yeah, I'm looking forward to that. That's going to be a good time. Yeah. Fair play to Mick Hucknall.
Yeah, fair play to Mick Hucknall. He's actually blocked me on Twitter.
What did you do?
He searches his name, and I think if it's not a bit like the Lighthouse family, they search their name as well. But if you don't say anything totally favorable of Mick Hucknall, you will be blocked. There's a huge percentage of people on Irish Twitter who are actually blocked by Mick Hucknall. So
I'm gonna have to go and check if I'm blocked by Mick Hucknall, because I've definitely said some slightly unfavorable things about him in the past.
Well, listen, it's a good club to be in.
Ooh, I'm excited now.
Aww. Okay, so we got Boney M, Beautiful South. Who else is on the...
Mary Black.
Of course. Is this Mary Black herself or part of the Woman's Heart collective?
So I think later we had the Woman's Heart CD, like a little bit after I was out when I started discovering more music. But for the first couple of years, it was just Mary Black's greatest hits. Tumbling Curls of Green by Stained Glass Streaming Lights. Oh my God. Like, come here though. Here's the thing. Say what you want about Mary Black, but those songs legitimately stand up now. Like, if you were to listen to them, obviously the production is a bit cack, you know, it's a bit Celtic mysticism on an American tour with like five lads that you went to school with and, you know, mammies just love them kind of thing. Like, that's the production. I think she was the blueprint for Celtic mysticism touring acts, realistically. But the songwriting that is there is so strange and so good. Like, so, I don't know, there's no formula. Like, if you look at, like, I'm trying to think of a song now. I guess Katie, lyrically, is, like, a very strange song. Like, what's it about? I don't know. Is it about, like, her lesbian lover that's, like, left her? Is it about her daughter that's run away and died? Is it like her sister? Like, there's no, like, it's a really ambiguous female relationship song. I'm obsessed with that song. I think that's a great song. I would kill to write a song like that.
Well, I can see, like, what you've all, like, listed so far, especially Boney M, I can see in your music today.
But you can't see any Mary Black?
Oh, I can see Mary Black. There's definitely, you definitely have that, like, sorrow that she has going on.
She's a lot of sorrow, man. She's got so much sorrow. I hope she's okay. I love Francis Black as well. Francis Black was on the Woman's Heart CD. Do you know what song's on the Woman's... Sorry, this is just me going off. Do you know what song's on the Woman's Heart CD that absolutely slaps? I don't know if it's the original release or like the second one, but the Corrs doing the Chieftains cover of I Know My Love. That's an absolute bop. That is so good. That's like a pure... I don't know how to describe that. Like, when's the last time... Do you know that song?
Well, I'm sure I do, because I would love every kind of unplugged arrangement by the Coors.
Yeah,
but I think when Andrea is kind of like let loose in, like, because that's like her, that's her genre. Like, yeah. Okay, she's great as being like the pop star, but when she's able to kind of like lean in properly into that like gorgeous kind of traditional singing, she's kind of unparalleled, I think.
When she's allowed to do sexy trad, and I think that song is like sexual trad. It's like very like, I'm being cheeky, I'm being flirty, I'm being raucous, but it's very trad. She excels at that. Do you ever see that video of her on stage at Croke Park and she plays the tin whistle and she like pulls, I imagine, I don't think this is what she does, but I always imagine that she's like pulling the tin whistle out from between her cleavage, because she like walks to the back of the stage and then all of a sudden she turns around and there's a tin whistle in her hand, and then she kind of like lightly like plays with it on her mouth before she actually starts playing with it, and it's just porn. It's like traditional Irish porn. It's so sexy. She's so cool. She's such a hero, like, secretly.
Like, it is actually amazing when you look back to, like, when they, around the kind of Talking Corners time, when they would be on Top of the Pops, and there she is, like, in a little, like, silky nightgown dress thing, and just, like...
liquid satin black.
Yes, so much eyeliner, messy hair, and then she whips out the tin whistle, and she'll do her bit, and then next thing it's like, and next up we have Robbie Williams with No Regrets. It's like, that is so mad that is that they fit in. That they fit at that time, but they were also like just so amazing. And if it was in someone else's hands, it would be like so twee and so horrible.
Yes, but I think the sexiness saves them from being Celtic mysticism on tour. I think that is their saving grace. I love the Coors; they're great.
In this new weird world of entertainment, I know that you and I have both watched Robbie Williams do Instagram lives where he does karaoke.
Yes.
So now there's a man with maybe more money than personal taste.
Safe to say.
So when you're like I've been really loving the fact that the Instagram lives and all like Zoom performances, you can actually see people's gaffes. Like right now, as I'm interviewing you over Zoom, you're doing a full face of makeup.
Beautiful. I know, sorry.
Yeah. But yeah, we were kind of getting a real insight into just how they live. And a lot of the time I'm kind of like, I don't know if that is the life that, you know, if I had all those millions, if that's a life I'd like to live, because a lot of their homes just seem quite, I don't know, quite like, just there's no love there.
No, there's no pictures on the wall. There's no cracks in the carpet. There's no weird wallpaper that your granddad got in the sale bin at B&Q 2 years ago and then decided to put up all over the house, which is what my wallpaper is.
And it's gorgeous. It tells a story.
It's got a story, yeah. Celebrity, this, that's why I feel very strongly about secondhand items. I'm very into antiques. I'm very into vintage fashion, like genuine vintage, because it's always got something messed up about it that you can be like, ooh, what happened here? Especially if you see, like sometimes I come across dresses that have been re-altered since, like that would have been re-altered maybe in the 80s or something, and it's like that they've been let down or they've been like lengthened, like, ooh, someone went home with this dress and their mom was like, not a chance you're going out in this, you better get this longer. I like to just imagine conversations between people.
That would kind of play in massively to your Western Girls DJ collective. Is collective the right word?
Absolutely, yeah.
So you are a big country and Western fan.
I love country and Western. I love it so much. It's just the best. Yeah. Just the best. It's in terms of pure trash aesthetics with a heart, as in we're going to go out of our way to look like the peak of glamour, but also there's going to be a twist in that we're going to do it very badly. That is like that in and itself, that statement alone, like whenever something makes that statement, either, you know, out loud or just inherently, I'm sold. Everything, like golden age of country glamour aesthetics is like, it's just beautiful.
So I got a two-part question then with that. So who would be your style icon within the country and Western world, and then who would be like your music icon, or do they cross over?
Oh, there's a lot of crossover. I mean, in terms of style icon, I love Tammy Wynette, because she was definitely dressing younger than she was, and she like she had an esthetician with her. Like, she was the first person to have like a makeup artist on the go, and like had no shame about it. And her excuse is always like, oh, I have like six kids, so I can't do it myself and I don't have time because I'm a mother. But like, really, she just wanted to have like full face beat 24/7, never show anything other. I love, yeah, I think like hyper feminine queens, like definitely Tammy, definitely Loretta, obviously Dolly Parton, but Dolly Parton is a very obvious one. There's also the likes of like Jeannie C. Riley, who does Harper Valley PTA, and then immediately after that song went back to doing Christian music. If you ever kind of see the publicity tours that she did, the outfits that she wore were class. And she had this kind of Bobby Gentry hair, where it was obviously a wig tucked underneath her own hair. So it gives you this, I guess early Lana Del Rey is what the hair is, where it's just a full bouffant that then goes straight back down your back. And if it's not done well, it looks like you're wearing a helmet of hair. But I love it when it looks bad. So Jeannie C. Riley always kind of looked crusty and crunchy, and I love that. But then, like, obviously, Bobby Gentry is very cool and beautiful, and her makeup was class. So there's a, yeah, that kind of aesthetic really appeals to me. But then in terms of music, I mean, I'm definitely more attracted to songwriters than I am singers. And like, I love Tammy, but you know, like, Tammy wasn't a songwriter. So in terms of who my heroes would be, like, I love Bobby Gentry. I just love Bobby. She's fantastic. Like, I don't think anybody's ever written a better song than Ode to Billy Joe, like, legitimately. And then, like, in the, I think I definitely liked, like, when I was a teenager, and I think who I'm probably more sonically inspired by would be the kind of female freak folk singer-songwriters of like the late 60s, early 70s, who were really heavily influenced by country music. Best example is probably Dori Previn. Like, Dori Previn is also, like, I also don't think anyone's ever written a song as good as Lady with the Braid, if you know that song. It's a very special song. Bleeding, what's his face? Father John Misty does a cover of Lady with a Braid. And I remember seeing that he did a cover and I was like, this isn't for you. It's like, this is a woman's song. Because I had a really, really deep connection with that song. Because it's about being a lonely, pathetic, real loser of a woman who spends a lot of her time alone. And I would definitely relate to that. And then when I saw him doing it, I was like, you're a liar. You're a liar, Father John.
And did it work at all? Or could you just like not distance your own feelings from the original for him to?
Oh, I mean, he's a beautiful singer. He has a really beautiful voice and he's a really talented songwriter. As much as I think a lot of people are loath to say that because they don't necessarily like his persona and they don't necessarily like a lot of what he brings to the table as like a public person. I mean, I don't know anything about him as a real life person. I know a lot of,
you know, the persona.
A lot of the arseholery is definitely performative. Like, he's doing it for a reason. I think he's antagonizing people for a reason. Now, I don't know what that reason is, because I like personas that are like, you know, a bit more friendly, a bit more soft, a bit more warm. But, you know, he has a reason. He has a mode that he's doing.
I love that Lana Del Rey's most of Norman fucking Rockwell is like allegedly about Father John Misty. And
the
it's just
the first song. Oh,
goddamn,
God.
Man child. Oh.
Yeah. And like, 6'2" is his exact height. And the thing, your poetry's bad and you blame the news. Like, his whole last that Pure Comedy album was like, I mean, some people reviewed it really well, some people reviewed it really poorly. I didn't like it. Because I'm actually a really big Father John Misty fan. I didn't like that album because I thought he was trying to do something. He was like, I'm going to make an album about America and I'm going to make an album about Donald Trump and it's going to be an intellectual piece of pop music and blah, blah, blah. And I think if you ever go in with an intention of doing something like that, it never reads well. It never reads well and it's never honest and it's never good. And I think,
yeah, I kind of feel like he maybe fell too much into the character. Like, I feel like he's kind of maybe a casualty of his own self, if that makes sense. Because, like, I Love You, Honey Bear, I think is just like, a perfect album. Like, I love it so much.
It's him contradicting the persona. That's what that album is. It's him basically being like, okay, yeah, I'm an ignorant arsehole and I've done all these bad things, but now I'm in love with my wife. And it's great. And it's really nice. It's like really touching. And it's an honest portrayal of love. And like, I don't know, it's a very, it's like willingly clueless writing about love, where you're just like, I'm in love with you and we're gonna stay together forever and ever and everything's gonna be perfect and I finally met the person that I love and everything's gonna be fine from now on. And it's really, there's a lot of subtext in the sense that's like, okay, clearly with the past that I have and the experience that I have, this is not going to go smoothly for a very long amount of time, but I'm gonna enjoy it while it lasts. I think,
but even when he's complimenting her, he's like tearing strips out of her as well. So like, it's a man who actually just can't give love without like total barbs stuck in as well.
Absolutely. But I think that's everyone. Maybe not everyone. I think I'm a bit like that as well. So I kind of, yeah, like, it's fucking complicated. I love him. I actually love him. I'm like, the more I talk about him, like, yeah, no, I'm obsessed with him. I'm like giving out about him, but I actually really rate him highly. He's great. I think he did well to move away from Fleet Foxes and stuff. Like, I think he did well to kind of move more into,
I'm surprised he lasted so long with that whole Fleet Foxes, that's like run through the trees and play with the fairies shtick.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not gonna lie, I love that shtick, but I don't connect with it in such a way. Like, I think it's really nice to sometimes just stick on that first Fleet Foxes album. Your man Robin Pecknold was like 23 when he wrote that. He was like 22 or 23 when he wrote and produced that fucking album, which makes me feel like shit, because it's great. It's actually a great album. Even if lyrically there's not much for me to sink my teeth into, I think it's like standalone. Pretty good, man. Not gonna lie. Well, I could talk about this shit forever, but I won't.
Let's talk about your music.
Yes.
Okay, so the first time I came across you was as Badsy. I think I first came across you... No, actually, I saw you perform at Hardworking Class Heroes. I think you were playing Workman's, is that correct? Around...
Yeah.
2016. Okay.
So or that's... maybe 2015. Maybe it was late 2015 or 16. I think late 2015, actually.
So I think I was reviewing it. I can't remember which website I was reviewing Hard Working Class Heroes for, but like, you were like the standout act. And I remember everyone in Workman's just been like, whoa, that voice. Aww. Because, yo, we'd never heard of you before. And then when you see just two people go on a stage, you're kind of like, okay, what's this going to be? And then your voice just like kind of like reverberated throughout the room and everyone's like jaw was on the floor.
Thanks, guys. Retroactively.
Thanks to the crowd from 2016 Hard Working Class Heroes.
Yeah, fair play to y'all.
Yeah, for showing up and supporting Irish music all that time ago. And then I suppose maybe I followed you on Twitter. And then
I actually think you might have followed me beforehand, because I remember meeting you there and being like, oh, we follow each other. And I think you were like, oh, this is you. I think it kind of clicked at you afterwards that you're like, oh, this is that. No, I get you now. Because a lot of people had that reaction when I started publicly doing music, because I always did music. Like, I was doing music. I had a song that I wrote and recorded when I was 12 years old, like played on Spirit FM or something. Like, I was doing it for a very long time, and then I kind of didn't do it publicly for a very long time because I was a teenager and the hormones set in and I was like, everything I do is bad. But I think a lot of people in Dublin music knew me as like a fangirl, because I used to go to everybody else's gigs all the time and be super complimentary and be like, I love your music. I love everything here. I think it's so great. I think it's so great that you do music in Dublin. Maybe one day I'll be able to do it. And like, I think a lot of people were freaked out by me. Shout out Connor O'Brien from Villagers. I'm very sorry for stalking you for 4 years when I was a teenager. I still don't know him. He's like the only person that I haven't like met, but I think he knows me as a previous stalker. I'm very sorry. Just gonna clear the air there. I'm very sorry for coming to every single Villagers gig for like 4 years and being like, I'm obsessed with you. I think you're so great. I love your songwriting so much. So I think when I then started actually doing my own music, there was a couple of people who were like, oh, she does music. That's why she was so weird, full on. She wanted to do it. And that, I think that was the reaction a lot of people had at the start. And then, yeah, and then Bad Sea happened. And then it didn't. And now I'm back again.
And now you're back at CMAT.
Yeah.
So the album, the song, or your single, Another Day, KFC, has been out 2 weeks now. Is it two
it
weeks?
Has. Yeah. I think. I don't know. 2 weeks? What is time?
What is time? We've known.
Time is not real anymore. Time does not exist.
But like, it's been doing well.
Thank you. I was hoping that it would. I'm not going to lie. I did spend a lot of time and energy and someone else's money on getting it recorded. So I really needed it to just not even do well. I just needed people to be like, oh, this is good. And use that as like a jumping off for then the next single that I release. And then be like, okay, it's good. I wasn't wasting my time. I wasn't wasting the last 3 years or something. Which is a crazy long time. I'm trying to think. I stopped doing music in 2017, so it's been 3 years then. That's wild.
And you moved to Manchester in between Bad Sea and now?
I moved to Manchester because my old manager, basically, I think he kind of copped that there was something going on. He didn't know quite what was going on in terms of me not being happy with the music that I was making anymore. And he was like, I think maybe Kira should just do music by herself now. And then I went over to Manchester. And then the guy that I was in the band with also came over to Manchester. And but I was like trying to pursue co-writing and stuff in London. I was experimenting with a lot of different kind of styles of songwriting. I was really into, I gave some pop songwriting classes in Manchester and stuff. Like I was just, I got really, really full into just songwriting by itself. And then I broke up with my ex-boyfriend and then I had to move back to Dublin. and then that all fell apart. But then it was good because then I was like, I don't care anymore. I'm just going to write songs the way that I think is actually best. And I'm going to try to get the most out of songwriting for me. And that is the best way of moving forward. And then I did that. And then like within a year, I'd released a single, which is like within that amount of time is quite fast, I think, considering the fact that I'd basically started from scratch again. So it's really cool to have people be like, oh, like good job, like it was worth it. I was like, thank fuck, because I would have literally died if people have been like, this is crap, like what were you doing for the past 3 years, why did you waste so much time, why are you expending all of your family's energy? I was like, but it's good.
Do you find that you've become kind of more decisive in what it is that you want to do because you've kind of experienced what you didn't enjoy in terms of putting out music and in terms of how you create that music? So yeah, like
yeah. I think I've definitely learned how to kind of not stand up for myself, because I think when I was 18 and recording like Bad Sea songs, it's not like I was being bullied. It's not like anybody was like, you know, this is the way it should be and we're not going to do things your way. It's not like that, but it's just a case of I'm 18 years old and I'm in a room with a lot of men who are in and around their 30s. And that was the case for most of Bad Sea. They were either in their 30s or they're a bit older. They're always significantly older than me. And they had been doing music for a lot longer than me. So even though I wrote the songs, like even though I was the songwriter, even though people were there for my songs and they were there for me singing, I couldn't get that into my head. And I was like, if I speak at a turn, everyone's going to think I'm a moron. Like everyone's going to hate me. Any suggestion that I make is going to be a bad suggestion, so I'm just going to keep my mouth shut. And I think that was pretty much, no, I'm sure Ollie, who produced the KFC single, and he also produced the first Bad Sea single, he'll be like, you were really loud. But in my mind I was actually quite quiet. I wasn't really decisive. I wasn't able to tell people what I wanted, just because I was younger and I didn't have as much confidence. Whereas now I'm definitely, I don't even think it's confidence. I think it's delusion. I think it's just like, listen, I've been in music the least amount of time out of everyone here, but I'm still better than you. So I'm going to make this my thing. And then we're going to leave the room. We're not going to talk about it again. And I think decisiveness and confidence is just so important. for actually getting what you want. Yeah, I know that sounds really obvious, but it's like a really hard thing to tell yourself when you're 18. You have to literally be like, even though you're talented and even though people are here for you and your work, you still just feel like they're only doing this because blah blah blah, they're only doing this because blah blah blah, like you make excuses. And you need to not do that. You need to not do that, kids. Don't be like me.
When you do go through working with people who are maybe older than you or a little bit more experienced than you as well, there is that kind of like fear of whatever you do, at the back of your head or maybe at the front of your head, you're kind of going, well, they're going to be judging this completely. So it's nice to just ignore that. Like if they're judging, just learn to not care.
And still do
what you feel is the right thing to do.
And I mean, ultimately, I think no matter what industry it is, I mean, generally this happens more at the creative industries, but like no matter what job you are, like if you are in the room with people who are more experienced than you, you're still there for a reason. Like they want you there. They asked you to be there. They want to work with you. So you need to get it in your dingus little head that your ideas are good. And even if they are stupid, even if they are clueless, the other people in the room will just chalk that up to a lack of experience, and they're usually not out to get you. Like people aren't out to get you. People aren't like, ha, I knew it. I knew you were stupid. I knew everything you've ever done has been wrong. People don't actually think that. It's just with the fake conversations that you have with yourself in your brain prior to going into the room. That's how those conversations go. So then you think that's real life, but it's not real life. No. It's not. People are sound generally.
Yeah, and people are never thinking about you as much as you fear that they're talking about you.
Absolutely. Absolutely not. No one gives a shit. Like, ultimately, it's music. It's a song. It's a fucking song. I'm sorry. Like, I love music. Music is the most important thing in my life. But at the end of the day, you're not doing brain surgery. Like, it's a fucking song. If it's bad, if it goes badly, nothing bad is going to happen as a result of it. If you are a songwriter and you go into a co-writing room, or if you go into the studio and you're like, oh, I have this idea for a song, what do you think? And they're like, this isn't good, I don't like this. You just write another song. Just write another song. It's like, it's not, you're not thrown out of brain. You know, it's fine. Just get a new one.
Yeah, just chop and change that course. It's fine. If that course doesn't work now, it will work another time.
Oh my God. And you know what? Editing is the hardest thing to learn how to do, because you're like, no, I worked so long and hard on this. Doesn't matter. Work longer. Work harder. Get your shit together. Fucking work that pussy, you know? Step your pussy up. Just chop and change it. Throw it in the bin. It doesn't matter. It's not important. Just get it together. I'm now talking to my previous self. Like, I wish I could, like, get a time machine and go back into a room when I was 18 and be like, shut the fuck up. Just, like, stand up for yourself and, like, get it together and, like, throw things in the bin. It's fine.
But then we wouldn't have CMAT as you are now.
True, 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 true. I mean, I ended up learning that lesson, but it just took a very long time, you know. But I think it does. These things do take time. So it's fine.
Yeah.
Fine.
So crying in public places, that is the main theme of KFC.
That's the theme of my life. That's the theme of my of my whole mission of songwriting. Love good cry in public. I mean, I hate it at the time, and I do it a lot, and I hate it in the moment. I'm like, oh, everyone's looking at me, it's the most embarrassing thing in the world, and everybody fucking hates me, and I've never done anything good in my life. And then you get home and you're like, oh, nobody cares. but it's good to bottle the shame in these things for songwriting use, you know.
Yeah, I cried in Burger King in Grafton Street when I was about 17, like proper heavy sobbing, crying. And the guy working at the till just came over to me and gave me a free Fanta. And I've forever felt indebted to Burger King.
Isn't that the best thing? Isn't that the best thing in the world? That has happened to me on at least 3 occasions. That is the best thing. When I was 17, I remember being at a house party in Funboyne, County Meath. Shout out Funboyne. And I like fell down a hill, and I was wearing like, you know, one of those sheer dresses, but they have like a slip underneath. Yeah. The slip came off at some point. So I was just like, the skirt was like hanging around my hips, and I was basically in my bra, and sheer, and I had fallen downhill. And I went into the, I didn't know where my friends were, so I like went into the chipper looking for them. And I went into the chipper, and I was just like sobbing, crying. I had blood all down my legs because I had like really badly fallen down a hill. I'd like blood everywhere. I could see my bra. Everything was bad. Like nothing was going well for me. And I was sobbing. I was like, and this tiny little woman came out from behind the counter. I think her name is Julia. And she came up behind the counter with like a piece of chicken fillet wrapped in a tissue.
A piece? And,
yeah, a piece of chicken one fillet piece. Wrapped in a tissue. No, but it was like a big piece, you know, like a big chicken fillet.
Okay.
And she handed it to me, and she was like, if you eat the piece of chicken, it'll make you feel better. If you eat this piece of chicken, it'll make you feel better. I was like, thank you. And then that made me cry more because it was such a nice thing to do. Plot twist, I had been a vegetarian for 4.5 years, and I ate that piece of chicken because it was the nicest thing anybody had ever done for me, and I have not been a vegetarian since.
And now you got a song out about KFC.
And now I have a song about KFC. Yeah. Oh, what a time.
It all comes down to breaded chicken.
It does. Ultimately, the world revolves around deep fried breaded chicken because it is the best tasting thing. You can't tell me different. You can't tell me different. And you can't tell me that it's bad for me because I just feel like it's done so many good things for me that you, I don't care about
personally, physical health. Emotionally, creatively. Creatively?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Creatively. There we go.
Creatively.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Like it's, you know, who cares about physical health, you know?
Yeah.
Not me.
What I really like about you, and you've kind of touched on this already, is that, like, you're such a music fan. Like the fact that you kind of said that like loads of people knew you from being a super fan of Irish music before actually releasing your own stuff. And you're so passionate about country music, you're so passionate about indie music, and you're so passionate about pop music. But you have them all on the same podium. So there's no like you're not kind of going, oh, my guilty pleasure is this. You're just like, no, this is all, they're like full equal pleasures, each and every one of them.
I don't, the term guilty pleasure does not align with my fantasy. It does not fit into my life. It's not, there is no guilty pleasure. If you feel guilty about liking something, then you're not smart. I'm sorry. You're not smart. You don't know enough. You don't know enough things about the world. You shouldn't feel guilty. You shouldn't ever feel guilty about liking something that is art or even a person, you know, like, you know, when there's these like guys that they're like, they're bad guys. They're like little shitheads. You're like, but I like them though. I kind of like them though. Like, don't feel guilty about that. Just own it. Just work with it. I think it's a good way to live. Like, it's a spicy way to live. Don't feel guilty about liking things, even if they're, you know, a little bit spicy, a little bit, ooh, he's going to get me in trouble. I'm going to go for it anyway. That's the best way. It's the best way to live. And I don't believe in guilty pleasures. And I mean, like, at the end of the day with music, you have to think of it in, it doesn't matter. It does not matter how the music is made. It does not matter how it is produced, because at the end of the day, there's always a person behind the song. There's always, even if it's, you know, like, talk about a Max Martin song where there might be 8 songwriters on the track, there might be 10 songwriters on the track, or it's, you know, manufactured pop, it's produced pop, and they're like, oh, it has no heart, it has no soul, because it takes a team of people to work on it. It's a team of people working together to produce something that other people are going to love. That in and itself is heart. Like, that's that, like, that is a form of self-expression. Obviously, it costs a lot more money, and there is definitely, you know, money behind it for the specific person of selling music, but there's always somebody working in the room that is there because they just love music. Like, you won't, any good song, like, it shines through the heart, the person that is there working behind the song, it shines through. It always does. There's always someone who just really, really wants the worth to be the work. Do you know what I mean? So I, like, yeah, they're all on equal pedestals because there's all people behind them, you know.
And even like that bit where we say if someone has just written a chorus, a part of a bigger song, that chorus belonged to a song that was entirely about their life at some point. So
absolutely,
it's like that chopping and changing thing of And that's kind of what I do like a lot about pop music, because it's just a lot of moving pieces around until they make the best overall piece.
Yeah, absolutely. And even, you know, there's obviously some people that are there for monetary gain. Like Max Martin makes no secret about the fact that he does not care about lyrics. Like that man does not care about a lyric. But I still believe that he loves music, because it would be very hard to make music as good as he makes without I don't think he's thinking about, oh, if I put this, you know, little vocal sample in the bridge here, that's going to make me an extra million. Like, it doesn't work like that.
But like, he's not lazy. Like, there's a lot of songs that are in the chart that you can be like, okay, well, that was a paint by numbers lazy song. But like, you cannot never accuse like Max Martin of being lazy. Because if you just even look at like Blank Space by Taylor Swift, like that's not a throwaway song.
Oh my heart. Oh, what a song. I love that song so much.
Like, that song took so much effort to make, and it's not like everything that he makes is just like under this magnifying glass, where he's not going to just throw something out.
No.
To make a quick buck.
Another person we haven't touched on is Taylor Swift. Remember when I said that I like wrote a song that I sang on when I was 12 and it was played on radio? That song, and I still remember it. I still remember how to play it. It was like the first song I ever wrote. Carbon copy of country music, Taylor Swift. I'd say the first 100 songs that I wrote between the ages of like 12 to 13 was just me doing an impression of Taylor Swift. I am not mad at that at all. I wish I kind of still wrote like that. I'm not even gonna lie, because I was so obsessed with her. She's so amazing. And she's another really good example of the fact that you can have, there can be 100 people in a room and just one of those people is Bradley Cooper, and he's there to work on the song because he loves it. Like that, like that's pretty much her whole career from after the point of country music, is like there's hundreds of people working on those songs. Like there might only be 10 people listed in the credits, there's hundreds of people working on those songs, there's hundreds of people working on those albums, but she's always there, and she always is there to make the song about her. And obviously that's a really vain thing to do, that's a really self-obsessed narcissistic thing to do, but it comes from a genuine place of, I need this song to do something for me, I need this song to empower me to expel a certain demon from my head. And she's amazing at that. I love her.
There's probably like a thing as well, like say if someone else is like writing that song for her, like someone is writing that song for her, and then she gives it her thing, that makes sure that she's making sure that song can be shopped out to somebody else.
Yeah,
like only Taylor Swift can sing that song.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even if, you know, even if she did want to shop the song out to somebody else, she would still not shop it out to somebody else unless it was really good. Like these people, they don't, like the likes of Charlie XCX, when she is selling a song to someone else, she's like, she's not selling a song to someone else because it's not that good and she doesn't need it for herself. She just sells a song if she's written something and she's like, this doesn't actually sit with my persona as well as that might for this other artist, but it's still an amazing song. Like that song she wrote for Selena Gomez, Same Old Love, she was like, I really feel like I should keep, I listened to an interview that she did about it, and she was like, I really wanted to keep it for myself because I knew it was going to be a hit, but the lyrics that we happened to write for that song, I think she wrote it with this guy called Ross Golan, she's like, the lyrics that we wrote for this specific song were so lined up with what was going on in Selena's personal life at the time. It was a much more important song to give to Selena than to take for myself, because I wasn't going through a breakup at the time.
Well, Charlie XCX, like, amazing. Like, I love that she has like those two sides of her, where she knows, and I know she's given out about the fact that she has never had her own big pop hit, but like
she gives out about that, but she has had her own pop hits. Like, she's delusional, she had Boom Clap.
Yeah, which she hates.
We all hate it, but I'm just glad she had it. Like,
yeah, but like she is doing well. Like, so she can, like, so she co-wrote Senorita for Shawn Mendes and Camila Cabello. Obviously, she could never release that song herself, but like, why would she want to sing that song? She wants to sing songs that's about taking yokes and getting fucked up with your mates and like probably like crying on the streets over a silly argument with your fella. And then just get back to fall in love, because she's kind of like the messy pop queen with a very clean production finish.
Have I ever told you that she's the reason that I broke up with my ex?
Oh no, but please do go on.
I did a, so I did a songwriting, it was like a songwriting workshop with Charlie. Like 2 years ago. It was like she just picked people. It wasn't a huge thing. It was like she picked people off Instagram to come and listen to her demos and to come and listen to stuff that she was thinking about putting out. I think she's put out everything that we listened to. We listened to two versions of Blame It On Your Love. And like it was really good. Like it was really nice to be in the room with her. And I was like, oh, you need to take like this verse with this pre-chorus, because we're listening to like a couple of different versions of things. I think I really insulted her at one point because she played us a demo of 1999 and she was like, I don't know if I'm going to release this song. I don't know if it's me. I don't know if I'm going to release it. And everyone else in the room was like, oh, you should release it. Like, it's really good. And she like looked at me and was like, I think you might have something to say about it. And I was like, it's obviously a good song, Charlie, but it just feels like a step back. I was like, I don't like that song.
It doesn't fit in on the album like at all.
No, it upset.
I skip it every time.
And I think her label kind of made her put it on because they were like, it's a formulaic pop hit and it will get charted. It's an easy sell. It's an easy sell to the charts compared to all the other wacko shit she does. So like, let's just stick that on there. And I think that's what ended up happening. But yeah, I remember like really badly giving out about 1999 in the room. I was like, I don't like this at all. But then afterwards, like, so everyone was kind of like talking amongst each other. And she kind of came over to me and was like, I feel like you do music for like a living. I was like, I don't do it for a living, hon. Like, we're not that rich. But I was like, yeah, I do it. And I was like, I came to like England to like pursue co-writing and stuff. And she literally was just like, so what are you doing? I was like, oh, I'm like living in Manchester and I'm trying to pursue co-writing. Yeah, but what are you doing? It's like, ooh. Oh, like I moved to Manchester. Why didn't you move to London? It's like, oh, London's really expensive, but are you doing co-writing in Manchester? It's like, no, I'm kind of coming. I feel like you should have just moved to London. Where are your friends? She's like, where are your friends that do music? I was like, oh, I feel like my friends who do music are back in Dublin. And she was like, okay, well, I really feel like you need to make a decision on what you're gonna do, because it feels like she was like so straight. She was like, I really feel like you need to make a decision on what you're gonna do, because I feel like you've good contributions, like you could easily do co-writing in London, but like, you know, you need to move here. She's like, you need to go for it, like you can't just kind of half-arse it. She's like, what else do you do? I was like, oh, I do like guitar music as well, which is like my way of saying I do like alternative music, because I was so stuck in the pop world at this time. I was like, oh, I do like I do guitar music as well. And she's like, so what are you better at? But ultimately she was just basically like asking really harsh questions. She's like, I think ultimately what she said, she was like, you need to make a decision on what you're doing, because she was like, are you doing music or are you just like trying to do it?
Just talking about doing music, yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, I don't know. And then I was like on the bus back from London to Manchester. And I remember like just sitting and I was like, I need to break up with him. It was like really, it was really funny. And then I probably didn't do it for another couple of weeks. And then eventually I did it. And then that's when I started to like properly do music again and like do everything for myself again and like learn to write for myself again. But I really do credit her with like just putting a gun up my bum and being like, get the fuck. She was basically like, either need to go back to Dublin and be with your friends who make music, because that's the only way to make music, or you need to fully go for the pop thing in London. But she was like, you need to do what you're better at. I was like,
that is amazing, because like
she was giving out to me like, and she was dead right, because I was cheeky as fuck with that 1999 thing, and I think she wanted to come back around and be like, okay, yeah, you're talking so much shit, what are you actually doing, bitch? And I was like, nothing. But I loved her for that. I really
but like,
do
you need someone to be blunt like that with you sometimes, just to be kind of like, okay, you can talk about writing or you can actually write.
Yeah, and yeah
like,
yeah.
That's
you can sit in loads of rooms with people and, you know, workshop other people's songs, or you can just fucking write your own songs.
Yeah. And like, I know it's very easy to go black and white, just like either do the thing, because like you have to work through anxiety, you have to work through fear, you have to like figure out your confidence and all that.
It was a financial thing for me as well, like, because I had no money into this day.
But like London, don't move to London. London's a terrible place. No,
I don't come from money, so I can't move to London. Like, that was basically like, I don't come from money. I don't have money.
But I like that she, I like that she asked you, she's like, where are your friends? And it's like, Dublin. Well, that's, they're the people you're going to be working with.
Yeah.
They're the people that you can like spend a weekend with working on stuff. And yeah, like you say, it's not at a financial cost because you're just sitting in each other's living rooms or yeah, bedrooms or whatever.
But it's funny because I didn't even realize what she meant at the time. And now, like, I fully realize what she meant in the sense that, like, when I'm recording music, I don't record in Dublin. So I recorded all the group of songs that I have kind of coming out over the next year. I recorded them all in New York with a guy called Ollie, who's from London. Or actually, I think he's from Penrith, but he's like my producer guy. He's my number one. He's so talented and he's just really, really good in the room. So I went to New York, recorded with Ollie from England. The girl who drummed on all of them she's American, but she's not from New York. And then the guy who played the saxophone on all the tracks was from Dundee in Scotland, which was really funny because when we were recording, his sister was like in hospital about to give birth. And I was like, what hospital is she in? And he was like, oh, she's in Ninewells. And I was like, my little brother works in Ninewells. My little brother's a nurse who lives in Dundee and is working in Ninewells, at that time. And he was like, is it okay if I leave my phone on while I record? I just want to make sure I don't miss anything. I was like, honey, go ahead. Like, it was so exciting. And then we were like, Scotland, Scotland, Scotland. Because my two siblings, like, studied nursing in Dundee in Scotland. It was very funny. But, so I, like, basically what she meant was you need to be around contemporaries who are trying to do good music, and you need to be friends with them, and you need to be able to talk with them, and you need to be in competition. Not in competition. I mean, I'm a little bit competitive. Not competitive, but just if someone talks shit about me, I will be like, okay, but are they right though? And if they are, then I'm like, okay, then I need to become better at music than them, so then I can shove that up their bum.
I think in a way, in music, it's healthy to be like as you are, because like you're so supportive of other people whose music is great.
Yeah.
But the best way to be competitive is kind of with yourself, because it's that thing of kind of like, okay, well, if you're going to talk shit, you have to actually deliver.
Yeah.
So that's maybe what the competitive kind of edge is that you need to do what it is that you're doing. And like, you are doing it. Like, it's really fucking impressive that you just had this big turnaround. So Batsy was 2016, sorry.
Is what 2017 when it ended. Yeah.
And now it's 2020 and now you just did a big turnaround. It's basically like someone just kind of like, well, Charlie XCX basically slapped you across the face. It's like, get your shit together.
Like, where? What are you doing? Get out of here. Get out of here, whore.
Yeah. And then, and then realizing, because she does come from money. So she was able to dive into being a pop star when she was like 14 or whatever. But to know that obstacle of, because a lot of people in the Irish music industry do come from money where they it's just a case of kind of like, I'm just going to set up a studio in my parents' back house or whatever. Yeah. You know, like,
that's do you know what, right, when I was in Bad C, this was a huge, I couldn't get over that. It really, really bothered me, and it really affected me emotionally, the fact that there was like, because I was working in Supervalue, full time when I was doing Bad C, and I used to cry about it. Like, I'd be like, it is so unfair that I work so hard, like doing two things in order to support myself doing music. And I work so, so hard. And there's bastards out here that have all the money in the world to just fucking sit on their gooch the whole day and like play around with Ableton for the crack. Whereas for me, it's always like, okay, I'm working 5 days this week and I have to do this on the weekend. So I'm going to spend like 8 hours of this one day putting my notes together. It's like just literally getting all the notes that I haven't put my notes together. And then the week after, I'll try to record a demo. And then that, like, that's generally how I've always worked. And like, basically, like, I have this small amount of time. So I'm literally going to like punch it together, like get my shit together. And it used to really upset me, but now I have the opinion, I'm like, okay, there's always going to be rich fuckers in the world. There's always going to be people that have loads of family money that don't have to work as hard as I do. But isn't it a good thing that they're spending their money on art and music and not spending their money on being a member of Young Fine Gael? You know, like, I've no issue with these posh people who pretend to be working class and, you know, go to NCID or whatever and spend all of their hobby money on like doing arts and crafts or whatever it is, because at the end of the day, they could be in Young Fine Gael, and I'm glad that they're not. I'm glad that they're ashamed enough of themselves to not be in Young Fine Gael.
I mean, we could all say that to ourselves, really, couldn't we? It's like, at least I haven't chosen that path.
I'm like, you know, like I could be angry about it, and I used to be so angry about it all the time, and now I'm just like, you know what, it's not my problem. That is not my problem. And I also genuinely think that because I've had to work so much harder at music than those people, that's the reason that I'm better. And I do think I am better than most people in Irish music. And that's delusion. That's pure delusion. That's pure delusion. But you need that. You need delusion, and you need to have some kind of sense of superiority to get you through, because it is a mortifying ordeal to do music. It is mortifying.
Well, yeah, you have to believe in yourself that it's worth putting all this time in, and then you have to convince yourself as well that you're worth other people spending their time on as well. So like, that's the thing, you have to believe in yourself.
Who would choose this path? Who would choose this path? No one should. It's an awful ordeal. It's an awful way to live, but I love it. I love music, so you know, I don't really have any choice.
Okay.
So it just reels you back in.
So what's going to be the next? So we're still in phase one, debut single, thriving. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What are we going to see next from you?
There is a music video for Another Day KFC that legitimately is the best thing I've ever done. It might literally be the best thing I've ever done. I don't want to give the game away, but in terms of representing me, in the sense that it's got, you know, the reference points that I pull from that are quite wide, and like bringing them together, and also it just being funny as hell, because it's funny and it's musical and it's pretty and it's good, it's really good, it's really, really good. I'm not even gonna lie, I'm not gonna be modest about it. It's a fucking great video. I love it. It's so good. I've watched it so many times.
If Charlie XCX could see you now.
She would hate my music, I think. She would actually probably hate the music that I do, but I think she would love that I'm doing it.
And that's all that matters, that you're fucking doing it.
Yeah.
Oh, class. Thanks so much, Kira. You're a good woman. That's all we can say, really, on the matter.
As are you.